first base. After Michael had congratulated Kel for closing the deal, he saw Manny standing on the mound, cap backward on his head, mask in one hand and mitt in the other.
"That was the greatest ending of the whole year,"
he shouted at Michael. Michael came over to him, grinning. "Only because it gave you a chance to hug Maria."
"Shut up,"
Manny said. Then the two of them gave each other five, first up high, then down low. As they walked off the field, Manny said,
"You sure you're all right?"
"We won," Michael said. "I don't know what it would have been like if we lost, but we didn't lose. I told you all year this team would be good enough to make it to Williamsport without me." Manny put an arm around Michael's shoulder. "Star?" "What?"
"Let's not get carried away."
"I'm cool," Michael said. Just less cool. A lot less. When he looked up and saw the Grand Concourse coach, the man from the ACS, standing behind their bench, motioning to Michael that he wanted to talk to him.
"Remember me?"
he said, sticking out a hand that Michael thought was surprisingly small for a man.
"My name's Tony Gibbs."
Michael shook it. "I know who you are," he said. "From the other night."
"I'm happy things worked out all right for you guys," Mr. Gibbs said. "But I'm sorry you couldn't play."
"Me too," Michael said.
"Rules are rules," Mr. Gibbs said. "Even when they're dumb rules that grown-ups came up with."
"Yeah."
"I left a message at your apartment," Mr. Gibbs said. "Then I tried the work number your father left on file, at the car service."
Michael couldn't catch his breath. Felt like he did one time when he wasn't looking and a hard throw from Anthony had hit him in the stomach.
"They said he hadn't been there for a few months," Mr. Gibbs said.
Michael thought to himself, is that all it's been? But he knew Mr. Gibbs was right. Poppy had died in May. Now it was August. It just seemed so much further away sometimes. Something that happened in the life he and Carlos and Poppy used to have. Now Michael wanted Carlos here with him, right here, right now. Carlos telling him the right things to say, the right lies to tell.
"My uncle," he started to say.
"Yeah, I know, he's sick in Florida. That's why your dad has been away."
"But he'll be back soon," Michael said. "My father, really?"
Really? Where the heck did that come from?
"How are you guys getting by, him being away this long?" Mr. Gibbs said.
"My brother has two jobs,"
Michael said. Too loud, too fast.
"Good for him,"
Mr. Gibbs said, smiling at Michael, as if neither one of them had a thing to worry about. He was just asking a few questions here, like a teacher going over a simple homework assignment. Like they were on the same page, even though Michael knew they weren't even in the same book.
"Has he come back and forth at all?"
"Who?"
"Your dad, from Florida."
"One time," Michael said. "He drove all the way back a few weeks ago, when he thought my uncle was starting to get better."
A good lie, Michael decided. Good boy. Not too big a lie. That was the key. Carlos had been saying all along that the simpler the lie, the easier it was to remember. Mr. Gibbs wore a gray Special Olympics sweatshirt and blue jeans and old running shoes and a black baseball cap that said Arthur Ashe Foundation over the bill. Behind him, Michael could see his teammates packing up their gear, the ones who needed a ride getting ready to board the bus for the drive back across the Bronx to Macomb's Dam Park, where they'd get picked up by the parents who hadn't made the game. Mr. Gibbs sat down on the bench and patted the spot next to him, as if he and Michael had all night. When he took off his cap, Michael saw a lot of curly black hair. He was young for an official person, Michael thought. He'd always thought of them as being older than churches.
"Well, you probably know why I'm here, kiddo. We gotta come up with that birth certificate, and fast."
My brother has been trying to call some of my father's old friends in Havana, Michael said. And my father, of course, he's been doing the same from my uncles.
Understand, we told the coaches who made the complaint that we're comfortable with what we already have. But they've called the folks at the district office, and the district office says that because you're such a great pitcher And because your team has such a great chance to make it to the World Series, they don't want there to be any controversy, the way there was a few years ago.
When Danny Almonte lied about his age, Michael said.
You know about him?
Everybody in the Bronx does.
Michael imagined a tennis ball bouncing back and forth across a net.
I want to help, Mr. Gibbs said. Michael wanted to say, sure you do.
Thank you,
is what he did say.
Tell you what,
Mr. Gibbs said. If your dad's not back next week, why don't I stop by the apartment and see if I can help your brother out? This is a pretty complicated job for a 17-year-old kid.
Okay,
Michael said. I know this probably doesn't make any sense to you, Mr. Gibbs said. Sometimes it's the grown-ups who act like children.
Michael heard Mr. Minaya yelling at everybody that he could still see a lot of garbage to get back there and police the area one last time.
For what it's worth, Michael, Mr. Gibbs said, I'm on your side. I work with a lot of kids around your age, and I think I know a 14-year-old when I see one, or at least like to think I do.
I'm 12,
Michael said. Then he couldn't help it. This wasn't one of the times he could stop himself. He started to cry.
Hey, Mr. Gibbs said, putting an arm around him. Everything's gonna be fine.
Michael nodded, as if agreeing with him, rubbing his eyes as he did, feeling like the dope of all times, the dope of the whole stupid world, hoping that nobody on his team could see him acting like a baby.
I know, Michael said. You know what they say, right? Mr. Gibbs said, still wanting to be his friend. Somehow, Michael knew what was coming next. No crying in baseball, Mr. Gibbs said. Not even Little League baseball.
Manny tried to pump Michael for information on the ride home. Michael told him they could talk about it on the phone later. He didn't want anybody else on the bus to hear.
You're asking me to be patient?
Manny said.
You know I don't do patient.
Just this once.
Okay,
Manny said.
But let's not make a habit of it.
Mr. M did what he'd been doing the whole All-Star season when the Clippers had an away game, dropping Michael in front of 825 Girard and not pulling away with the old bus until Michael was inside the front door. Everybody on the team knew that Carlos worked most nights and had heard the story about the sick uncle in Florida and thought Victor Arroyo was still away. So nobody thought this was star treatment for Michael. Even if they did, Manny always pointed out, nobody would have given a rat's rear end. His words. Michael told Manny to call when he got home, promising he'd tell him everything about his conversation with Mr. Gibbs. Then he got out of the bus, ran up the front steps, took the stairs up to the apartment, unlocked the door, made himself a humongous chocolate milkshake, remembered with a slap to his forehead that the Yankees were on Channel 9 tonight. Regular TV. He could watch. They were playing the Texas Rangers at home. The announcers were saying that tonight had been family night at the stadium, and there had been a one-inning game before the start of the regular game that involved some of the Yankees and their children. That was why the Yankees-Rangers game had been a little late starting. Keith Wright, the Yankees' rookie left-hander, was pitching tonight and had a 2-0 lead in the third inning. Michael sat on the couch, happy as always to have the Yankees' company in the empty apartment. On the screen, Keith Wright threw a big, slow, breaking curveball that seemed to come up to the plate as slowly as the one that El Grande liked to throw. When the batter missed it by a mile, the camera went into the Yankee dugout and found El Grande sitting there with a couple of teammates, pointing at Keith Wright and laughing his head off. Then the camera went to a box near the Yankee dugout, where Michael Kay, the Yankees' play-by-play man, said El Grande's family was sitting tonight, saying that it was unusual for the children to be here. They usually only came when their father was the one throwing the big, slow-breaking curveballs. A little girl's face filled the screen. Michael Kay said that was El Grande's 3-year-old daughter, Adriana. While the camera was on her, she turned and tried to climb over her seat into the box behind her, her mother grabbing her from behind right before she went up and over.
The older daughter, Michael K. continued, is named Elisa.
That's right, Michael, Jim Cott, the Yankees' other broadcaster, said. Elisa Garcia Gonzalez, a name as pretty as she is.
Michael stared at the screen.
She's beautiful, Michael K. said.
No, Michael Arroyo said. She's Ellie.
Chapter 15. The office of the Bronx Borough President, Mr. Amorosa, was located on the Grand Concourse, and for all the worrying Michael had done about going there and having his picture taken with Mr. Amorosa and Officer Crandall and Mrs. C., the whole thing had been about as exciting as posing for some dopey class picture. Carlos went along too, getting the morning off from the Imperial, switching shifts with a friend. When Mr. Amorosa asked about their dad, Mrs. C. stepped right up and said she was standing in for him, once again being their honorary grandma, and that her dear, dear friend Victor Arroyo sent his deepest regrets from his brother's bedside in Florida. When Mr. Amorosa said he'd say a prayer for the uncle, Mrs. C. made the sign of the cross. Knowing Mrs. C.'s theories about sin, Michael figured she'd be on her way to confession as soon as they were done. There were four photographers in front of Mr. Amorosa's building. Michael wore his white church shirt with the stiff collar and the tie Carlos had given him, one that was way too long for him. When they were in place on the front steps, Mr. Amorosa stepped to the microphone that had been set up there, even though there was no crowd to watch them, just the photographers. He presented Michael with a baseball signed by the Yankee starting pitchers, including El Grande, and a Bronx Good Citizen plaque with Michael's name on it, and a brief description of how he had felled, that was the word they used, a robbery with courage and quick thinking. Then Mr. Amorosa made a brief speech in which he said pretty much the same things that were written on the plaque. "We hear all the time in baseball about pitchers mowing batters down," Mr. Amorosa said. "This time, a fine young man from our borough mowed down a petty criminal who had preyed on this sweet old woman standing next to me." The ceremony took 10 minutes tops. When they were done, Mr. Amorosa posed one more time, shaking Michael's hand as the photographers took their pictures. Then he wished him luck in the upcoming playoffs, even saying he might try to catch a game. Michael knew there was probably as much chance of that as Mr. Amorosa wading into the Bronx River and catching fish with his bare hands. When they were finished, Michael noticed that the cameras disappeared almost as quickly as Mr. Amorosa did. Carlos asked Michael if he wanted to ride back home in the car Mr. Amorosa's office had provided. Michael said no. He and Manny would walk. Michael had asked Manny to tag along, knowing he would. This was a big event in Manny's eyes, even if it didn't include him. He lived for events of any kind, big games, school field trips, even if they involved going to art museums, school plays, the opening of any new movie they really wanted to see, even if it meant getting permission to take the subway all the way to Times Square, pay their way into one of the massive theaters Manny called Plexiplexes. As soon as they were back on the street, in front of 851 Grand Concourse, Michael yanked off his tie as if it had been a noose around his neck and stuffed it into the pocket of his old navy khakis.
"What did I tell you?" Manny said. "No problemo."
"Yeah, we had him all the way," Michael said. "I wish I could get Mr. ACS man off my back that easy."
"We'll think of something," Manny said.
"You just keep thinking, Butch," Michael said to Manny, using one of his favorite lines from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, one of his favorite movies. "That's what you're good at."
"You should have gone along with my brilliant idea about a fake dad," Manny said.
"Why?" Michael said. "So the fake dad can come up with a fake birth certificate?"
"You know what I'm saying."
"Not always," Michael said, poking Manny with an elbow. They were in no hurry to get back to Girard Avenue, no hurry to do anything, really. The sound of the day, of the city, was all around them, as loud and busy as ever. It was another reason, Michael thought, why he loved baseball so much, loved the idea that all the action didn't start until he started it by going into his motion. There he'd be, alone on the mound,
the ball in his hand, the ball feeling as small sometimes in his palm as a marble, almost like he was alone in his own world, not even hearing the infield chatter from behind him. Sometimes Michael thought the two most quiet places in his whole world were the pitcher's mound and the apartment at night before he put the Yankee game on. Manny said,
"Well, are we gonna talk about her ever?"
He poked Michael now, as if waking him up.
"How much more can we talk about her?"
Michael said.
"She's not just a girl. She's El Grande's daughter. That happens to mean she's living in a whole different world than we're living in."
"But she's been hanging around in our world 'cause she wants to," Manny said. "Nobody made her."
"Why couldn't she just have told us who she really was?"
"Because," Manny said, "she was probably afraid you'd get your panties in a wad exactly the way you are right now."
He put both hands over his heart, put his head back, closed his eyes.
"Oh,"
he said,
"I am just a poor Cuban boy from the wrong side of the four tracks, and I'm not worthy."
That was as far as he got before Michael stepped back and gave him a soccer-style kick to the seat of his pants.
"Hey,"
Manny said,
"that actually hurt."
"Good.
She likes you,"
Manny said now. "It doesn't change who she is."
"I know,"
Manny said.
"She's the great man's daughter, and yet she keeps coming around."
"At least now we know why she only showed up on days he was pitching," Michael said. "She must come in with him instead of her mom, and then get a little bored just hanging around the ballpark."
"I told you, she likes you," Manny said. "Deal with it."
"She doesn't like me enough to tell me the truth."
"Hey, jerkwad," Manny said. "Maybe you've noticed, people sometimes have a good reason for holding stuff back."
As usual, when it turned into a debate, Manny had him. They had walked long enough now that the stadium was in front of them. Manny told Michael to hang on, ran into a convenience store, came out with a couple of Snapple iced teas with lemon, handed one to Michael.
"Where do you suppose she lives?" Manny said.
"Riverdale," Michael said.
"You know that?"
"I read it in the papers." Riverdale, they both knew, the most expensive part of the Bronx, like a whole different Bronx, on the Hudson River side of the Henry Hudson Parkway, with big old brick mansions looking like castles guarding the river below. Michael had seen them once on a boat trip up the Hudson their sixth grade class had taken.
"She could have told me,"
Michael said one more time, being stubborn the way he was with pitches sometimes, going for a particular corner of the plate, inside or outside, even when he was missing.
"Are you thick or what?" Manny said. "She probably only hangs around with kids who can't get over the fact that she's El Grande's daughter. Look at her for herself. And then she finds us, and it's completely different. We don't know anything. We just like her for her. You and your faithful companion."
"Which would be you?"
"Friends to the end," Manny said. "And then 5 days after that."
They touched their Snapple bottles together. "I want to see her again," Michael said, even though the thought now scared him.
"Duh,"
Manny said. "You think she'll come around when the Yankees are home next week?"
"Duh,"
Manny said again. "But what if she thinks I saw her on TV, and now I know who she is, and she just doesn't want me to turn into another El Grande groupie?"
"Star."
"What?"
"Will you listen to me for 1 second?
"All I do is listen to you."
"I mean, really listen," Manny said. "You've got enough crummy stuff going on in your life. They won't even let you play right now. But Ellie isn't part of that. Ellie is a good thing. A good problem to have, am I right?"
Michael mumbled his reply on purpose.
"I didn't quite catch that,"
Manny said. "I said you're right." Manny Cabrera, light on his feet as always, more graceful than all the people who called him No Neck knew, danced now on the Bronx street corner, Michael's catcher celebrating as if he'd just scored a touchdown. Chapter 16. Tony Gibbs had spent most of the morning at a group home just up the block from the basketball courts at Rosedale Park. It had been a good morning. No, a great morning, because of the news Gibbs had delivered there to a 12-year-old orphan named Belice Ortega. Both of Belice Ortega's parents had been killed on 9/11, The father, a security man in the North Tower, and the mother, a receptionist at a bond trading company on the 101st floor. The two of them thrilled because they could make the long train ride to work together every morning. Belis was an only child. He had gone into the foster care system and ended up at this group home. Now Tony Gibbs told the boy that he had a foster home for him in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Gibbs lived for these days. Belis Ortega had met the foster parents twice. First, when they came to visit him in the group home. The second time, an overnight visit, approved by the ACS, to the family home in Ridgewood. After that, as always, came the worst part for these kids, the waiting period, to find out whether or not they had made the cut. Sometimes this went on for weeks, before some family decided they didn't want some 12-year-old Dominican or 14-year-old Puerto Rican. Then Gibbs had to sit them down and tell them they hadn't gotten into the only club that any of them cared about, a real home. But this time, they said yes. The Kimballs were an older couple with kids already through college. They had decided they wanted children in the house again, had talked about various modern-day options, China, Romania. Then it turned out they had a friend who had joined the board of New Yorkers for Children, the city's best foster care charity. The friend had put them in touch with one of Gibbs' bosses at ACS. Finally, there came the day when the Kimballs came across the George Washington Bridge to say yes. Days like this didn't wipe out 100 bad days for Tony Gibbs, just carried him to the next good one. So on this morning, he helped Belis Ortega, a kid with the face of an angel, to pack his cheap bag, walked him out to the front door with the Kimballs, all of them turning around when they heard the cheers from the other kids in the group home hanging out the window. Gibbs cheered along with them. He hugged the boy and told him to have a great life and watch the Kimballs' Toyota SUV with jersey plates pull away. He thought about going back to his office then, in the Bronx Borough President's office on the Grand Concourse. Instead, because he hadn't gotten a chance to make his morning run along the East River today, he decided to make the long walk across the Bronx to Yankee Stadium, where he knew the Yankees were playing an afternoon game. He knew one of the cops who worked security outside the stadium. When Gibbs would show up after the game had started, whether it was a sellout or not, the guy would wave him in and tell him to go find an empty seat. Gibbs loved the Yankees almost as much as he loved helping these stray kids. Now he walked for an hour, forgetting how far it was from Rosedale Park to the stadium, hailed a cab, got off on 161st Street, 161st, and Girard. It made him think of Michael Arroyo, just because the kid had been on his mind a lot lately. Gibbs didn't walk up 161st toward the stadium. He hung a left and started walking up Girard instead, pulling out his wallet as he did, making sure he had the address right. He had done this sort of work a long time, working even harder at it after his divorce, throwing himself into the job with a vengeance. By now, he had a sixth sense about kids, whether they were in the system or not, whether they were on his Bronx Little League team or not. Something wasn't right in Michael Arroyo's life. He was sure of it. Tony Gibbs had a feeling, one of his famous gut instincts, that the kid's old man had run out on them. He saw the boy before he got to the entrance to 825 Girard, in an alley behind the building, throwing to one of those old-fashioned pitchbacks. Gibbs stood across the street, watched that beautiful motion he saw from the boy in games, the high kick, that perfect arm angle of his, the ball coming straight over the top, like Koufax, his all-time hero. Not many people remembered Sandy Koufax anymore. Maybe it was because Gibbs's dad had been an old Brooklyn Dodgers fan, one of the few who still rooted for them after they left for Los Angeles. They would watch Koufax when Tony was little, and his father would always remind him that Koufax had started in Brooklyn as a kid. Now he watched this little league boy who he believed had some Koufax in him, the boy, lost in what he was doing, taking it seriously, then throwing another one with all his might, that hit the net in a place that sent the ball right back to him like it was on a string. Gibbs thought, this is better than anything I'm going to watch today with the Yankees and Devil Rays. This kid is the real deal. A car horn finally distracted Michael Arroyo, and he threw one too high, and the ball came flying back over his head, right through the entrance to the small alley, and across the street to where Gibbs was standing. When Michael turned around, there he was.
Michael, I'd like to ask you a question,
Tony Gibbs said, picking up the ball, tossing it back with a little zip on it.
Where's your father? Really?
For some reason, Michael tossed the ball back to the ACS man, who caught it easily with his right hand. Just doing that, feeling the baseball in his hand, then throwing it to him, made Michael feel better, as if he could somehow pitch his way out of this jam.
What do you mean?
Michael said.
No games, Michael. Where's your father?
The two of them kept playing catch. Mr. Gibbs on his side of 158th Street, Michael at the entrance to the alley. Mr. Gibbs was wearing blue jeans again, a different sweatshirt this time, one that said, New Yorkers for Children. Michael wondered if he was one of those children.
My father's in Florida, Michael said. Tell me the town again,
Mr. Gibbs said. He made it sound casual, like they'd had this conversation before, but Michael knew they had never talked about what town Victor Arroyo was supposed to be in, visiting the sick brother who did not exist. Michael knew, and Mr. Gibbs knew. He remembered watching Law and Order one time with Carlos, and Carlos saying, lawyers never ask questions they don't already know the answers to. What did Mr. Gibbs of the ACS really know, now that he'd come around asking where Michael's father really was?
It's near Miami, Michael said. Carlos knows. The only thing I know about Miami is that the Marlins play there and beat the Yankees that time.
When did he go down there?
Mr. Gibbs said.
He didn't want to talk about the Yankees and Marlins.
I mean, exactly, he said.
He came over now to where Michael was, sat down inside the alley, his back against the wire fence. Michael noticed his sneakers. He always noticed sneakers, maybe because his were always so worn down, having to last him from the start of one school year to the start of the next. Mr. Gibbs's soft old Reeboks looked like they were almost as old as Mrs. C.
It was right after I got out of school,
Michael said.
Keep the lies simple.
Yeah, that's what they said at the car service, Mr. Gibbs said. But your dad only works there part-time, right?
He owns his car, Michael said. He likes to be on his own, my father. But they would call him when they needed extra drivers.
They said the 18th of May was the last time they heard from him, Mr. Gibbs said.
Yes,
Michael said.
Yes.
He said it very clearly. Poppy never allowed, yeah. Speak American, he always said. You're American now. Yes, Michael was thinking. May 18th was the last time the car service had heard from his father, because that was the day his father had died.
So he's been gone for over 6 weeks now?
Mr. Gibbs said.
He must really trust you and your brother.
Carlos says he's like the dad who had to come off the bench,
Michael said.
You sure he didn't just take off? Mr. Gibbs said. Your father, I mean?
It's a terrible thing to say, I know. But I see it in my job all the time.
He's with my uncle,
Michael said.
Why don't you believe me?
He wanted Manny to come walking right around that corner now. Michael, knowing that all he had to do was give Manny a look and his friend would know he needed help, as though Michael had sent an instant message right into his brain. Or he wanted Mrs. C to come walking up the hill from the Imperial. Or Carlos. Anybody.
Hey, relax. Mr. Gibbs said. It's my job to ask questions like this.
To everybody?
When I think there's a problem.
My uncle's the problem is all,
Michael said.
What's his name, your uncle?
Shoot.
Luis,
Michael said. There had been an old Yankee pitcher he knew about, just because they had the same last name, Luis Arroyo. He had first read about him in a book about Yogi Berra he had taken out of the library. Mr. Gibbs said,
Hey, that's funny. There was a relief pitcher once, had that same name, Luis Arroyo. But that was before your time. My father told me about him,
Michael lied. Did Uncle Luis come over on the boat with you?
No, he came a few years before.
Lie after lie after lie. And he doesn't have family of his own down there in Miami to take care of him? Michael said.
They stayed behind when he left, and then they didn't want to come later.
The questions were coming faster now. Michael felt the way he did when he sat in the subway car and the train was outside, and everything was flying past him. No one said anything now, for what felt like a long time, until Mr. Gibbs said, "There's no uncle, is there, Michael?" Michael took the ball out of his glove, bounced it off the pavement as if it were a basketball, did that hard once, then twice.
"You're calling me a liar?"
he said. "I think the lie is that your dad is ever coming back."
"No!" Michael shouted. "You've got it all wrong. You'll see."
"Will I?" Mr. Gibbs said. "My line of work, Michael, my job, I see parents running out all the time, for a million different reasons. It's not your fault or your brother's if he did." Michael didn't know what to say to that. "I can help you," Mr. Gibbs said. "You don't have to be afraid of me." He looked up at him, tipped an old Yankees cap back on his head. "I'm one of the good guys," he said. Michael blinked fast and hard a few times, determined not to start crying, because this was another time when he knew crying would be like some kind of confession on Law and Order. "If he's gone, you gotta tell me." "Gone," Michael thought to himself. Like Poppy had gone out for cigars and never come back.
"My brother and I are fine," Michael said. "We don't need your help."
"The two of you are too young to be living alone for this long."
"That's the thing," Michael said. "We aren't going to be living alone much longer."
The words were out of his mouth before Michael could stop them, like a cartoon genie blowing out of the bottle.
"So your father's finally coming home?"
Mr. Gibbs said.
"Day after tomorrow,"
Michael said. Chapter 17. Michael watched as Manny actually began to talk Carlos into it, it being his big idea that his uncle Timo, who had gotten some small parts in off-Broadway plays and even in some of the television shows shot in New York, could play the part of Poppy just for one day. They were in the living room. Michael had called Manny as soon as Mr. Gibbs had left, told Manny what he had told Mr. Gibbs about his father coming back the day after tomorrow. He had also told Manny to get his butt over to 825 Girard before Carlos got home from the Imperial.
"Why do you need me?"
Manny said.
"As moral support," Michael said. "As a human shield," Manny said,
and then told Michael he'd be right over. Michael expected Carlos to yell when he told him about Mr. Gibbs, but he didn't yell or walk out of the room. He just sat there on the couch, still in his Imperial white shirt and tie, and listened to Manny, as if Manny were now the one in charge here.
"This can work," Manny said.
"I told you," Carlos said. "I'm listening."
"We can make sure Uncle Timo's English is a lot worse than your father's really was," Manny said. "That way, he can act confused if he has to. Then all he has to do is keep thanking Mr. Gibbs for being this interested in his boys. Tell him he's working day and night to get that stinking birth certificate and that hopefully he'll see us all at the Little League World Series."
Manny stood up, bowed to the waist, then said,
"You've been a great audience. Don't forget to tip your waiters."
Michael had no idea what that one meant. He just laughed along with Carlos, who did seem to understand. Michael did this a lot, laughed at something Manny said, even if Manny seemed to be saying it in some kind of foreign language. Carlos said, "You're good, Manuel, and I'm sure your uncle is, but what if he makes a slip?"
"Let me ask you a question," Manny said. "What have we got to lose? This Mr. Gibbs was sure your father had just deserted you guys, which means he's gonna keep coming around like the truant officer unless we do something."
"I'm not saying we're just going to sit around and do nothing," Carlos said. "I'm just asking what happens if I agree to go along with your crazy plan and Uncle Timo makes a slip."
"He won't."
"How do you know that?"
Because I know my uncle, Manny said. My mother says he could sell sand in the desert.
He would do this? Your uncle?
He's my godfather, Manny said. He knows I look up to him, even though he's not close to being a star, because I think maybe I'd like to be an actor someday. If I ask him, yeah, I think he'll do it.
Carlos went into the kitchen, came back with a Coke, sat down now in Poppy's old recliner, with the tape on one of the arms and the cushion. This is crazy, Carlos said.
Our whole life is crazy, Michael said. I'm telling you, this'll work, Manny said. You and Michael can tell him everything he needs to know, and he can memorize it.
Michael saw that look come over his friend's face again, his big idea look.
We can even have one of those mock debates like we do in class before a real debate, and you can pretend you're Mr. Gibbs and fire questions at him.
Carlos looked at Michael, then Manny, then back to Michael. I can't believe I'm letting you two knotheads talk me into this, he said. Working two jobs must be making me way too tired.
I promise, this is gonna be great, Manny said.
Michael thought, Manny Cabrera is the one who could sell sand in the desert.
We just need to give him something so he stops coming around until you figure out a way to get that stupid birth certificate, Carlos.
I called Father Morales, Carlos said. Our old pastor, he was on vacation, but the priest who answered said he'd give him the message as soon as he got back.
So for now, we work on Uncle Timo, Manny said, clapping his hands. We gotta keep you guys together.
Carlos smiled and said to Michael, Al pan pan y al vino vino.
Hey, Manny said, no keeping secrets.
You never heard that one? Carlos said.
All I got was the wine part, Manny said.
Michael said, it's a Cuban expression about bread and wine, but it's really about calling things as they are. No lies. Until the next lie, Carlos said.
You guys call bread and wine whatever you want, Manny said. I'm gonna call Uncle Timo.
You're actually gonna let us do this? Michael said to Carlos before his brother went off to work at Hector's. As always, his brother was wearing his favorite baseball cap, the one with the W on the front, which Michael knew was for the old Washington Senators. Papi had loved the Senators when he was a boy, even though they were usually terrible, because their star pitcher was Camilo Pascual, a Cuban by birth. I am thinking about letting you do this, Carlos said, checking himself out in the mirror, making sure the cap was just so. Just because a few minutes with this Uncle Timo guy might get Mr. Gibbs off our backs. He pointed a finger at Michael, then Manny, then back at Michael. But remember, you two, nothing happens with Uncle Timo until I get to meet him tomorrow. Michael said, I'm just gonna tell him stuff about Papi's life. Tell him some baseball things about the two of us, and Manny thinks we should show him some pictures of all of us. And don't forget to show him some of the Cuban expressions I wrote up, Carlos said.
Do you think Mr. Gibbs will know the difference? Manny said.
Aquí hay gato encerrado, Carlos said to Manny.
Say what?
He's saying there's a caged cat here, Michael said. And the cat is me. I just want to make sure the cat has 9 lives, Carlos said. It got a smile out of Michael. Not easy these days. How many lives do I have left? He said to his brother. That's what we're trying to find out, Miguel, his brother said, and left for work. Uncle Timo showed up about an hour later, wearing a short-sleeved shirt outside his jeans, sandals, and no socks. He was still wearing his sunglasses, even though the sun was gone from the sky, and wearing the kind of backpack Michael and Manny took to school with them. He looked old enough to be a dad to teenaged boys, Michael thought. He even had a beard that reminded Michael a little bit of the neat, trimmed beard Papi always had. Uncle Timo was carrying a plastic bottle of water.
Dude, he said to Manny when he came through the door, giving Manny a big hug. Now you think you've turned into my agent?
Michael's heart fell now, hard, as if he'd dropped it from a high place. Uncle Timo sounded more American than baseball announcers.
And you, he said, rubbing Michael's head, must be the famous Mike.
He stepped back and put out his hand.
Gimme some, he said.
Michael gave him 5, but without too much enthusiasm. Uncle Timo noticed it because he dropped his head to the side and gave Michael a funny look.
Where's the love, dude?
Don't worry, Manny said, reading Michael's mind, as usual. He grows on you.
Uncle Timo dropped his backpack on the floor and plopped himself down in Papi's old recliner chair.
My nephew here gave me the setup, he said. And by the way, dude, I'm sorry about your pop.
Thank you, Michael said, thinking to himself, he's more of a teenager than Carlos is.
Manny laid out the plot for me, Uncle Timo said. I'm Dad, I've been down in Florida, I'm back for a day, just to check in on my boys, then I'm back down there with my illin brother.
Illin? Michael said.
Sick,
Manny said, then grinned and said,
Dude!
What if Mr. Gibbs asks where your brother is?
Got it covered, Uncle Timo said. I got a girl down there, her own place in Homestead, working a dinner theater down there. He calls that number, she's the maid, not so good, ablying the Inglesia.
Michael closed his eyes.
Besides, Uncle Timo said, Manny said all we've got to do is convince the man.
He made little quotation marks with his fingers around the last 2 words.
That I'm the man of the house, and that I trust you guys to keep things under control till I get back.
Manny said,
Sounds like a plan.
Manny says the guy thinks your dad turned deadbeat and ran out on you.
Michael looked at Manny.
He knows the whole story, Manny said.
You can't tell,
Michael said to Uncle Timo.
Dude,
Uncle Timo said, sounding hurt. Michael noticed that every time Uncle Timo said dude, he sounded more like Manny or Kel. Like a kid.
Seriously, he said to Michael. Don't worry. I don't spill my guts unless I'm getting paid to do it on a cop show.
Michael said, The one you have to fool, Mr. Gibbs, he's very smart, so you've got to be good.
I am good, he said. My agent tells me all the time.
Michael wasn't so sure. Uncle Timo was a goof, but at least he was trying.
What do you want to know about my father? Michael said.
First, I want to see him, Uncle Timo said. Manny said you've got pictures?
But I don't understand why you need them, Michael said.
Because if I'm gonna be him, I need to know what he looks like.
But you don't look anything like him, except for maybe your beard.
I don't look like him yet, Uncle Timo said.
Yet?
That happens, he said. When the magic happens, kid.
Michael went into his room, reached up to the shelf in his closet, got down the shoebox with some of Papi's stuff in it, the small stack of photographs that the nice woman, a stranger, had offered to take at the Bronx Zoo that time, Papi's cigar cutter, the old black and white team photograph of the Cuban national team, with Papi standing next to a smiling, happy bat boy at the end, one who didn't look much older than Michael was now. Papi said the boy had snuck into the clubhouse that morning, just wanting to see some of his heroes. The manager of the team wanted to throw him out, but Papi had liked the spunk it had taken to sneak in there. Then he had proclaimed the kid bat boy for a day, he told Michael every time he retold the story, and had gotten him into the team picture. There was a photo of Michael and Papi posing outside Yankee Stadium, next to the huge bat that rose like a skyscraper. There was the picture of Papi standing proudly next to his Grand Prix. Finally, there was the photograph that was Michael's favorite, from the spring, not so long before Papi had his heart attack. Michael, in his Model Monuments uniform, Papi with his arm around him, both of them smiling. Michael remembered Papi telling him that day that now he really was an official American boy. He was in Little League. Only now, he wasn't in Little League. Michael brought the box into the living room, set it on the glass coffee table, took out the Little League picture, and showed that one to Uncle Timo first. He carefully took the photograph out of Michael's hand, stared at it hard, walked over to the window that looked out on Girard Avenue, still staring at the picture,
as if frozen in that position. Michael whispered to Manny,
"It's like he's in a trance. He's starting to get into character,"
Manny said.
"It's an actor thing."
"Oh.
Remember that scene in Caddyshack?"
Manny said, referring to another one of his favorite movies of all time.
"It's like when Carl, the groundskeeper, tells himself, 'Be the ball.'"
"So he's trying to be the photograph?" Michael said.
"Something like that,"
Manny said.
"He's cool, isn't he?"
Michael didn't answer, because he was thinking, weird is more like it. This was never going to work in a million years. Chapter 18. Carlos had his own lies, separate from his brother's. Here was one. He had not worked at Hector's Bronx Cafe for a few weeks now. Here was another. At night, when Michael thought he was bussing tables at Hector's, Carlos was working outside Yankee Stadium, scalping tickets to Yankee games, as afraid of being spotted by his brother as by the police. And finally, the Whopper with cheese. His boss for this new job as ticket scalper, the one who actually dealt with the broker who somehow owned the tickets, was a young man his age named Ramon Crespo. The same Ramon who had stolen Mrs. Cora's purse. Carlos had met him a few nights after he got laid off at Hector's. He had done nothing wrong, the manager assured him. He had been one of their best workers since his first night on the job. But business was slower than they expected, even after Yankees games, and some of the waiters had agreed to take a cut in salary rather than be the ones laid off, and so the busboys had to go. Carlos was out of a job, at a time when he had a secret drawer full of past due bills in the apartment. "But I need this job," he said to the manager, a man named Jose Guzman.
"You told me you work at the Imperial," Mr. Guzman said. "How much can a boy your age need a second job?"
"We have bills to pay at home."
"I'm sure your father will find a way to provide," Mr. Guzman said. "And if things change around here, I will be sure to call you."
"You don't understand," Carlos wanted to say. "I am the father. Even if I'd give anything just to be a son again. To have somebody take care of me the way I take care of Michael." For the next few nights, he got dressed as if he were going to Hector's, his senator's cap on his head, and walked down to 158th Street instead, hanging around with boys from the neighborhood who would stand in front of Stan's Sports World. Somebody would always have a transistor radio to listen to the Yankee games, even though they would first try to guess what was happening inside when they heard the noise of the crowd before the announcers would tell them what had happened. One night, he was listening to one of the boys on the corner tell the story of how he had cried in front of the judge in juvenile court. Boo-hoo, getting a laugh now by touching his tongue to his cheek and leaving a wet mark there. And how the nice woman judge had actually let him off.
"I wouldn't have been there at all if that stupid kid hadn't clipped me with a lucky throw."
Carlos couldn't help himself. "He isn't stupid," he said. "And it wasn't lucky." Ramon gave him a little nod with his chin.
"How would you know?"
"That kid is my kid brother," he said. He shouldn't have said anything, but he was in a bad mood and this Ramon, with his slick back hair tied into a ponytail in back, reminded him of a weasel. He was wearing a 50-cent t-shirt and basketball shorts that were almost long enough and baggy enough to be a skirt. The purse snatcher didn't look so tough to Carlos. If he wanted it to be on, Carlos was ready to go. He even felt his fist clenching behind his back. Ramon looked Carlos up and down, like he was some kind of item in a store window he was thinking of buying, his face almost curious. Suddenly, he laughed.
"You're right," he said. "It wasn't a lucky throw. That boy's arm is, like, sick."
"You don't seem too mad about it," Carlos said. Ramon shrugged.
"Easy come, easy go," he said. "Besides, I don't have to steal old ladies' purses no more. I've got myself a real job now."
Then he told Carlos and the rest of the guys on the corner
about the scalper he had met at Stan's the week before. What he called the primo tickets the man had access to, how on a good night, his cut of those tickets could be as much as $50. Later on, when it was just Carlos and Ramon walking up 158th Street, Carlos on the lookout for Michael even then, even knowing Michael was home listening to the Yankee game on the radio, Ramon said,
"You know what $50 is in this neighborhood? 2 purses sometimes, that's what."
And more than I was making at Hector's, Carlos thought. Then he heard himself saying to the purse thief, who bragged about fooling a judge in juvenile court, who didn't seem to be afraid of official persons or anything else, "How could I get a job like yours?" Ramon smiled a smile that reminded Carlos not of a weasel, but a cartoon shark.
"When can you start?" Ramon said.
Mr. Minaya said he had a friend who had a friend at El Diario, the Spanish paper in New York, who was making some calls to Havana, trying to see if there was somebody down there who would be willing to help track down Michael's birth certificate. And Mr. Minaya said he had talked to Mr. Gibbs, the ACS man, about maybe contacting the Little League in Havana, finding someone sympathetic to what Mr. Minaya called Michael's plight. The ACS man, who was supposed to come to the apartment tomorrow and meet Manny's crazy Uncle Timo. Tomorrow was also the day of the Clippers' first playoff game against the Rosedale Park Robins to be played at Macomb's Dam Park. Anthony Fierro would start in Michael's place, trying to make sure the Clippers hung in there until they got Michael back. If they got Michael back.
"You know what's gonna happen?" Michael said to Manny. "Somebody's going to come up with that stupid birth certificate of mine, but it's not gonna happen until after the season's over. Wait and see."
"Well, there's a pretty great example of what my mom calls the power of positive thinking," Manny said.
They were sitting on the home team's bench at Macomb's, Mr. Minaya having insisted that Michael come to practice.
"They may not let you play," Mr. M had said, "but you're still a part of this team."
Problem was, Michael didn't feel like a part of the team.
"Look at it this way," Manny said. "Once you get out on the field, it'll only hurt for a little while."
"How do you know?" Michael said.
"I don't,"
Manny said.
"It just sounded like something I thought I should say."
He stood up.
"Come on, let's go test out the old rocket launcher, see if it's still firing on all cylinders."
"I know I've told you this before," Michael said, "but you sure can talk." Then they were out on the field, in the bright sun. Michael on the mound, ready to go into his windup, Manny in his crouch behind the plate, all the green grass around them, and Michael was throwing, and Manny was catching and saying, "Wow," or "Oh boy," on just about every pitch, the way they had so many other times. Better times than these, Michael thought, before there seemed to be something bad happening just about every single day. He went into his high kick, tried to put everything he had into his next pitch, and did something to Manny he did from time to time, when they both knew he had